Hello, and welcome to Adelaide Writers Week. I'm Jo Case. I'm deputy editor. Deputy Books and Ideas editor of The Conversation, and I'm the monthly books columnist at In Review. I'd like to start by acknowledging that we are meeting on the traditional country of the Kaurna people of the Adelaide Plains, and to pay respect to elders past and present. We recognise and respect their cultural heritage, beliefs, and relationship with the land. And we acknowledge that they are of continuing importance to the Kaurna people living here today. I feel really privileged to be here today to talk to these two writers about the deep influence of place on their work. Jonathan Leatham revisits his childhood territory of Brooklyn in Brooklyn Crime Novel, a beautifully crafted, dryly funny at times and thought-provoking, fragmented meditation on an ever-changing place that asks who belongs, who has the right to claim belonging, and how the characters within the neighbourhood form its ecosystem and change and are changed by it. Jonathan is the best-selling author of 12 novels, including The Arrest, The Feral Detective, The Fortress of Solitude and Motherless Brooklyn, winner of the National Book Critics Circle Award. Jonathan currently teaches creative writing at Pomona College in California, and yesterday I heard him tell Sarah Lestrange from the ABC that he no longer makes claims that he won't write another novel about Brooklyn, which makes me quite happy as a reader. Please join me in welcoming Jonathan to the stage. In A Day in the Life of Abed Salama, Anatomy of a Jerusalem Tragedy, Nathan Thrall takes on the huge task of attempting to tell the story of Israel-Palestine and the West Bank through the microcosm of one bus crash involving Palestinian kindergarten children 2 miles from where he lives in Jerusalem. And he's succeeded at making the world's most complex, contested international conflict, I think I can say, into a human story that reveals a divided society where one group of citizens live a radically different life because they are Palestinian. The book was named a Best Book of the Year by The New Yorker, Time, The Economist, The New Republic, and the Financial Times, and it was selected as a New York Times Book Review Editor's Choice. Nathan's previous book, The Only Language They Understand, Forcing Compromise in Israel and Palestine, was published in 2017, and his essays, reviews, and reported features have appeared in the New York Times Magazine, The Guardian, the London Review of Books, and the New York Review of Books, and have been translated into more than a dozen languages. Nathan spent a decade at the International Crisis Group, where he was director of the Arab-Israeli Project, and he has taught at Bard College. Originally from California, he lives in Jerusalem. Thanks. Please join me in welcoming Nathan. Thank you. Now, before we start our chat, we are going to hear just a little bit from both of these authors about their books. Who would like to go first?
Please. I'll go first.
You got the book in your hand.
I'll go first. So I'm just going to jump into the middle of this crazy voice of this book, which goes all over the place. But this is a bit about how shoplifting is important. For these kids, anyway, in this time, in this place, shoplifting is incredibly important. And it's from a chapter called Shoplifting as Skill Acquisition. The thing about shoplifting, boosting, is there's barely one kid who doesn't. Boy, girl, black, white, Puerto Rican, doesn't matter, it comes with the territory. Even the incompetent ones, the one-timers, they feel differently afterwards. Whole areas inside them exfoliate, stir into activity. The first day they go into a store with criminal intent, that's the day they've gotten separation, the day they've achieved liftoff, because this is a criminal world. You wouldn't want to be on just one end of it, would you? Always the victim, never the perpetrator? Recipient of the memo, taker of the call, unable to shout back? No. Shoplifting is skill acquisition. You might need it for later. A basic life art. Best to get these things under your belt. It pretty much always begins with candy. At a candy store or bodega, pity the bodegas. What chance do they have needing to guard a glass-fronted soda case in the rear, itself wedged behind narrow, loaded aisles, while also keeping your eye on the candy bars stacked right there at the counter, at the register, far too near the door? Does snatch and run count? Of course it does. Hell, even stealing coins from your parents' dressing table in order to purchase candy counts as a kind of participation. It makes a start, at least. Not everyone is ready for stealing from strangers. Some need to practice on a parent or sibling. Fulton, Flatbush, Smith Street, Vanderbilt Avenue, Hooper's store on Sesame Street, whatever. You steal because it's there. Candy, soda, comic books, baseball cards, cigarettes, beer, tampons, rubbers, horny goat weed, even before you knew what any of that stuff was for. Girls make the shift to lipstick and eyeliner and legs sheer energy pretty naturally. Do you guys know what legs sheer energy are? They're like stockings that come in a plastic egg for some reason. I don't know why that was a thing, but it was. Two or three black girls and one white girl, that's a team to confound Sherlock Holmes. Send them into Fort Knox, they'll emerge with the gold. Smartasses steal pieces of the city from itself, pry hubcaps off cars on a shady street, not because they're some resale destination, but just to put in your room for your parents to do a double take. Advertising from the subway, steal it because it's easily popped out of its frame. Whole subway car full of riders just shaking their heads at you, but what are they gonna do? Protect a subway advertisement? All of this goes without saying. It's taken for granted. You try it in pairs, usually, pairs at least. That poor, incompetent kid, sticky fingering the heavy metal magazine all by himself, what was he thinking? Boosting is an art one kid graduates the next into. Sometimes you pass along a good blind-angled spot and a useful target in a spirit of pure altruism. Just passing the art down the line to a younger kid who'll appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks for giving us an example of Riley Funny there. That's great. Nathan.
I'm going to read a passage from a portion of Abd Salama's life in prison during the First Intifada. And the prison he was taken to is in the Negev Desert, which is known in Arabic as the Naqab. And I will start with his interrogation. After his interrogation, Abd was sent to the Ofer prison near Ramallah, then to a detention facility in the Anatot base, which, as it happened, was built on land confiscated from his family. Detainees used buckets as toilets. Abd stayed there for 2 months and was allowed to shower only twice. Next, he went back to Ofer, where he was tried and sentenced by a military court to 6 months, then to Dahariya again, and finally out of the West Bank to Israel's largest prison, Ketziot, in the Negev Desert. It was built to confine the thousands of West Bank and Gaza Palestinians rounded up during the Intifada, at a certain point holding one in every 50 Palestinian men. Politically aware inmates named it Ansar III after the Ansar prison camp Israel had erected when it occupied southern Lebanon, but most referred to it by the Arabic name for the area since before Israel colonized it, the Naqab. Abd arrived in the Naqab in the winter, when the temperature of the desert nights would drop below freezing. The facility was made up of more than 100 crowded tents with a couple dozen detainees in each. Every cluster of 2 to 4 tents was surrounded by a dirt mound and enclosed with barbed wire. It was easier for Israel to control the inmates by giving some autonomy to the factions, allowing each to run its own tent. In Abd's cluster, there was one tent for the DFLP, that's the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, a left-wing PLO faction, one for Fatah, and one for the Islamists. When new prisoners were brought in, they would line up before the heads of the factions and declare their party affiliation. Not everyone had one, so this was the moment when they had to decide. Abd saw one prisoner approach the front of the line and declare, "I'm with the PLO," Everyone around him laughed. "We're all PLO," one of the party leaders said, since the PLO was not a faction, but the umbrella group for all the non-Islamist parties. "Okay, I'm with Abu Ammar," the man offered, using the kunya, or honorific, for Yasser Arafat. He was put with Fatah. 2 months later, Abid saw that this man, who had not known the name of the faction he joined, was now the head of Fatah education in his cluster. That, Abid thought, is how they choose their leaders. At the time, nearly half of the 13,000 Palestinians in Israeli jails were in the Nakab. The inmates included most of the more than 2,000 Palestinians held under administrative detention, that is, held without having been charged or tried, and with the possibility that their sentence might be extended indefinitely. Among them were journalists, attorneys, physicians, professors, students, trade unionists, civil society leaders, advocates of nonviolence, and members of Israeli PLO dialogue groups, which were illegal. Unlike Abed, most were not told the reason for their imprisonment. Each tent set its own daily schedule. Abed's DFLP tent held mandatory courses in party objectives, policies, and ideology, and instructions on how to withstand interrogation by the Shabakh. Some inmates read and translated newspaper articles brought in by their lawyers. Televisions and radios were forbidden. Great numbers of books were banned, from Shakespeare, Tolkien, and Tolstoy to Solzhenitsyn and the constitutional law of the State of Israel, and none of the prisoners was allowed a family visit. The tents had no tables or chairs, and they flooded when it rained. Even during dust and sandstorms, the soldiers required the tent flaps to remain open. The barrels used for trash overflowed each day, bringing a terrible stench and an influx of mosquitoes and rats. Many prisoners developed skin diseases. But the real torment came at sunset. Every night, the Israelis would turn on the speakers and play a heart-rending ballad by Umm Kulthum. She was Abed's favorite singer, along with Abdel Halim Hafez. He disliked pop music and listened only to the classics. The Israelis played a different wrenching Umm Kulthum song each night. Her songs were lengthy. The most famous, Anta Omri, You Are My Life, was almost an hour long. The anguished prisoners would lie on their beds listening, homesick, some of them crying, others working on the one letter they were allowed to send each month. Abed didn't dare write to Gazal. The Israelis read all the mail, and who knew how they would use the information against him or her. Instead, he would stand outside the tent and look up at the moon, wondering if at that moment Gazal was looking at it too.
Thank you. And I'll just add as context there that Gazal was the person who was the woman who Abed expected to marry at that point. That's a really great little sliver to share because it speaks to, as probably most things you would have chosen, speak to the fact to just how Abed's story illustrates the wider Palestinian experience. It just covers so much. I'm going to start by asking each of you to talk a bit about that that connection to place through your novels. Jonathan, you keep coming back to writing about Brooklyn and in particular to Dean Street, where you grew up. As I already said, I think that's a good thing. That street and the surrounding neighbourhood is the setting for Brooklyn Crime Story and for your 2003 novel, Fortress of Solitude. And you said yesterday that Motherless Brooklyn, your first novel set there, was a Valentine to the neighbourhood. And then with Fortress of Solitude, you drilled down to explore the class and race-based complexities of growing up there. Look at it with a more critical eye. So I wonder if you can tell us what drew you to return to that territory for this book and what were you interested in this time?
Yeah, so for me, place is always unbelievably powerful, but it's not necessarily something that I have embraced. Mm. It's power over me or inside me that I was from Brooklyn. It was something I first wanted to cast off or deny in a way. I ran away. Mm. I ran away to California, and I ran away, in a sense, even before that, into the world of books. Mm. I didn't read books set in Brooklyn. I wasn't interested in that. I read science fiction. I read crime stories. I was obsessed with the hard-boiled detective story, which is set in California. I read British novels compulsively. And when I began to want to write, I didn't want to write about Brooklyn at all. So this took a long time for me to accept, both as a destiny in my body, that I wanted to go back and even just be there, to walk around in New York City again, to go to those streets and live on them again, which I did a lot, wasn't obvious to me. It took a decade of holding it at arm's length. But when it came back in a flood. And as you quoted me yesterday, the first thing I did was sort of, Brooklyn, where have you been all my life? I wrote a big sloppy kiss of a book called Motherless Brooklyn, which was basically just saying, you are my people. I sound like you. I look like you. I talk this way. I get it. And I'm going to just brag about it and wear this place on my sleeve. And it kind of worked. It's a book people love because it's so full of my love for the place, in a way very unadulterated.
Yeah.
And that opened the door and allowed me to admit this depth of connection, which I've been resisting because the depth threatened, in fact, to be a kind of abyss. That actually the problem of being from where I was from was something I could be thinking about for the rest of my life and not solving. Really just even trying to frame the questions was gonna torment me and challenge every tool I'd developed at that point. You know, The Fortress of Solitude, my first attack on this, was my sixth novel. Mm. People often think you're supposed to write your big coming of age story or your autobiographical book at the start. I couldn't have dreamed of that. I needed so much tool acquisition to even get that close. And then I tried to cap it. I thought it was adequate. Well, 20 years later, I'm making a long story of this and I'll stop soon. 20 years later, with the world changing and Brooklyn changing and my relation to my own political desires to name things that I'd left unnamed, material I left on the table, all transformed, and with the increased tool acquisitions of being not in my early 30s, but in my mid-50s, and having written all these other books, and become a parent, and become a college professor, and I was able to go even nearer to that abyss in Brooklyn Crime Novel.
Yeah, okay, that's really interesting. I mean, when I looked back at Fortress of Solitude after I read Brooklyn Crime Novel, because I thought, I swear there are some elements in there that, you know, have resurfaced in a really different way. And I found it really interesting how you had done that. I guess before I move on to asking Nathan something, was that something that you consciously did, or was it just that's your material?
Well, I knew that I had this problem that was also an advantage, or kind of, at least it was a fascination. It's like the apes in 2001 who go up and touch the monolith. I had this object that I'd made that people had feelings around that attracted ideas and that I responded to. So what was I going to do with having gone there once already? You know, I wanted to evolve again and touch the monolith a second time. But I didn't reread Fortress of Solitude. I didn't really need to. It's all so tangible to me. And I knew I would regurgitate certain anecdotes or attitudes or feelings. Probably exact phrases recur. It didn't matter because everything else was so different. And that just became I'm going to change metaphors now. It's another kind of black box, is the one that sinks to the bottom of the ocean. All I needed to do is bring it up from the ocean. I did not need to listen to the recording.
Yeah, fair enough.
Just had it on my desk, thinking about it.
Well, I feel like they're great companion novels. I really enjoyed reading them side by side, and I also loved the way that you wrote a character into Brooklyn Crime Novel who has written about the neighbourhood. Like, he's just referred to a couple of times, but I'm like, oh, you're in there. It was great. Yeah. Nathan, you've written a book that tells the story of Israel and Palestine through a 2012 bus crash that injured and killed a group of Palestinian kindergartners on their way to a playground on a road that some called the Death Road. The elaborate system of control that governs the West Bank, including IDs, borders and sections, affected how this disaster unfolded. Can you talk to us about this? What happened?
Sure. So the basic spine of the book, despite what I read earlier, you know, it's called A Day in the Life of Abd Salama. Obviously, it's also the life story of Abd Salama and other people who intersected with this crash. But the spine of the book is really the day and the week of this tragedy, which involved a bus full of kindergartners from a walled enclave that is partially within the municipality of Jerusalem, the city that I live in. And these kindergartners live among about today 130,000 people without playgrounds or sidewalks or roads wide enough for one car to go in each direction at the same time. And it's closed off with a checkpoint that restricts access to Jerusalem. And the students in this kindergartner, they had came from different families within the enclave. Some had green IDs that are West Bank IDs that prevent them from entering Jerusalem. Some had blue IDs that permitted them to enter Jerusalem. So as a field trip, they couldn't go to the closest playgrounds, the closest play areas that were just on the other side of the wall in the Jewish neighborhood or settlement of Pisgat Ze'ev. And so instead, the bus took this long and winding path along the edge of this 26-foot-tall concrete wall that encircles the community on three sides. And after passing through a checkpoint, they were struck by a giant semi-trailer that was on its way to a settlement quarry in the West Bank, was getting stones to bring them to a factory that would then be used to make concrete for roads in Israel. And the road that they that the accident occurred on is in Area C of the West Bank. This is the part of the West Bank that's under not just full Israeli security control, but full Israeli administration. Israeli police hand out tickets on the roads in Area C. But this particular road was one that was basically used only by Palestinians at this point. It was originally built for settlers as a so-called bypass road, one of these roads that is built to go around Palestinian towns so that settlers have this kind of illusion of a seamless transition from Jewish West Jerusalem and Jewish Israel to their Jewish settlements and being able to kind of block out all of the Palestinian communities that they're passing as they go to and from their workplaces. But this road at this point was transformed, a new bypass road was created, and this was now a road used mainly by Palestinians. And what that meant was that it was a place that was really neglected by the Israeli authorities. Not neglected when there was any kind of attack on Israeli forces. Anytime kids threw stones on this road, the border police or the army would be there within minutes. But neglected in the sense that the hundreds of thousands of people who live in this area on the other side of the wall are entirely ignored by Israel. And the Palestinian Authority, which has limited autonomy in little islands within the West Bank, is not allowed in Area C. And so who was left to deal with this burning bus that was flipped over, filled with kindergartners, were just ordinary people who were driving on the road that day, Palestinians who themselves had either green or blue IDs. And they then went and there were a couple of people who heroically entered this burning bus. One was a teacher, another was a worker who fixed car tires, mainly for settlers, just at a shop adjacent to a nearby checkpoint. And they went into this burning bus and started to push these kindergartners out through the windows and hand them to bystanders who took these soot-covered kids into the back seats of their cars and drove off in different directions depending on the color of their ID. So if you were a driver with a blue ID that allowed you to enter Jerusalem, you would go to a superior Jerusalem hospital nearby. And if you had a green West Bank ID, you'd go in the other direction. And I tell the story of, the title character is Abd Salama, who's a father of one of the kindergartners. And by the time he arrives at the crash site, there's a huge crowd there, but all of the kids are gone. And they had all been taken away by bystanders. The first Israeli fire truck didn't arrive until more than a half hour after the accident. And Abed came upon this crowd and it starts asking, where are the kids? And he's told all kinds of different answers, that they're at the IDF military base just a minute up the road, that they're at this Jerusalem hospital, they're at another Jerusalem hospital, that they're at the Ramallah hospital. And because he himself has a green ID and can't access most of those places, none of the hospitals in Jerusalem and not the IDF military base, he goes to the Ramallah hospital and he calls on relatives who do have a blue ID to search simultaneously in the Jerusalem hospitals he can't access. And I tell the story of his search for his son, which lasts for more than 24 hours before he finds out the fate of his son. And through Abed and some of the heroic bystanders at the scene, some of the Jewish paramedics, the settler who founded the settlement adjacent to where the crash took place, I try and tell the broader story of Israel-Palestine.
It's quite extraordinary how you have used this quite simple, like it's a simple story to summarize in a line in one sense in terms of what happened, and something that it's hard not to empathize with, you know, children who've been killed, to the way you use that to map all the ways in which the system failed them, works against them, and interferes with a humane, just a logical humane response to something like this. How did you work out that this was going to be, you were going to be able to do this with this story? And were you looking for a way to do that?
I was looking for a way to do that. I really, the move to do a work of narrative nonfiction was a very instrumental or pragmatic one. I very much wanted to reach people who might not care about Israel-Palestine, but who might be drawn to the story. And I felt that there was an abundance of information out there about the system that all of these characters navigate. There are zillions of NGO reports about checkpoints and permits and land grabs and the division of area A, B, and C in the West Bank, the annexation of East Jerusalem. But, I don't think that you come away from those reports with a real visceral understanding of, what a moral catastrophe, really, this entire system is. And it's so robust. It's existed for more than half a century, and there's no end in sight. And so I have seen how people who visit Israel-Palestine, they go on a tour, and they immediately get it in their bones. They just see the moral catastrophe in front of them, and so I felt that a work of narrative nonfiction was really the best way to try and convey that, short of taking someone on a tour.
Yeah, and you've done that beautifully.
Thank you,
Jonathan. I'm interested in the way in Brooklyn Crime Novel you've made the neighbourhood itself like the main character, and it feels like in Fortress of Solitude, like they were such intricately detailed characters, and you know it's set in the same neighbourhood. And now in this one, the characters don't have names, but so much nicknames or initials. There's the spoiled boy, the millionaire's son, C, who's a very important character, the Wheeze. But the streets and the neighbourhood landmarks are named, including Dean Street. And I think that very cleverly works to make that, to really emphasise the neighbourhood being the character. Can you talk about how and why you did that?
Yeah, I was chasing a kind of idea about the neighbourhood and the street as a site where systems of characters, systems of lives were intertwined that was larger than any one consciousness could embody. And I knew that in a way I had to unmake some of my own habits, maybe even my desires as a novelist, to create the usual forms of identification, you know, kind of empathic, oh, this is the main character and here's the antagonist. Let's watch them go at it. You know, I was going to restrict some of these devices, partly because I saw this book as being one that was about a collective experience that was elusive, that no body could hold entirely. And that it was being experienced in some ways by the characters that way. Some of them almost experience these transpositions of themselves, these memories or projections where they're like, did that happen to me? Or did that happen to this other kid? You know, we talk about it all the time, but was I really there for that incident? Or did I just, did it become mythic to me on the street? It's a book partly about the legends and the narratives we make around experience. And so I had to change the configuration of kind of narrative juice, narrative energy, and make the reader look at their own operation and how they construct their interest in a place or a character differently. So taking away the names was a really simple way to say, wait a minute. We're going to do this a little differently here.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And as you were talking, I was just thinking that, you know, Nathan, you've both of you have kind of worked against the law in a different way from how you had before. You'd been a journalist and had written a book that was more looking from the public policy perspective, and now you've written something that's, you know, taking the human to show that. And Jonathan, you're working in the opposite direction.
Yeah, really, you can see these as moving in. In opposite directions. And, you know, as novels go, this one is a book that draws on methods from nonfiction, which took me a real, you know, when I talk about tool acquisition, right? One of the last things I learned to do, because I was a pure, you know, I thought I was a pure expressive artist. I grew up making paintings, actually. So when I switched to making stories, I was like, you just make what you think and feel. You move the paint around. I didn't ever train as a journalist, nor was I a very successful student. I didn't write, you know, a dissertation or a thesis. I wrote stories to move and entertain and maybe perplex people, but I didn't think about making things clear. I didn't know how to pursue that kind of clarity, but I had to learn a lot of that. So there's an essayistic component in my book that draws me, in a way, away from my instincts as a novelist.
Yeah, that's really interesting. You're both interested in exploring systems, like systems and control, and you've both moved out of your comfort zones to do that.
I would just add that what you said really resonates with me in moving the opposite direction. You know, several people have asked me, you know, what did you have a model in mind for this book? And I really did not. And in fact, when I was doing the research for it, I read nothing but fiction. I was just constantly reading fiction, and I was just trying to reinforce for myself the truth that there are no rules. Mm. As long as what I'm writing is factual and I can back it up and it's a fact, there are no rules, and I needed to free myself because there were all kinds of structural challenges to the book. I was operating on these two different timelines. One is the timeline of the crash, and each character's point of intersection with the event, and you want to introduce them at the moment of greatest impact. But at the same time, a lot of why a character is there is actually their backstory. Yeah. And that backstory has its own timeline. So it was a real juggling act.
Yeah, welcome to a novelist's problem.
Yeah. Yeah, and you can see, I mean, as I was looking at your book, I really was marveling at how much is in it. Like, and because the first thing you are drawn to is the characters, but then when you drill down to all the components, there's just, yeah, so much information that comes through them. Nathan, I wonder if, I mean, you can tell us, you've said that Abed has lived the history of this place, and that's partly why you chose him, and we got a sense of that just, you know, from your reading before. And you said his story is also one of Palestine over his lifetime. Can you tell us a bit about him and how he embodies that?
Yeah. So when Abed first finished reading the book himself, he didn't read it until it was already a hardcover, which was a very hard thing for me to decide about when to show it to him. But when he first finished reading the book last August, he said to me, you know, there's another character in the fifth part of the book, the final part of the book, whose story is much more tragic than mine. And he said, why didn't you center it around her? Or, you know, why did you choose me, he said. And the answer, I mean, was really that the ambition of the book was to tell the whole story of Israel-Palestine, mm-hmm. and through Abed's life story, I was much more able to do that.
Yeah.
He had just finished high school, just before the First Intifada broke out. He was born just after the occupation began. He came from a very prominent family in this Jerusalem area town. He watched as these lands were transformed. And he became politically active. He was just, history sucked him in.
Yeah.
And he became, not by choice, but the leader of the local DFLP in his town of Annata. Mm. And he went through torture and imprisonment, and his entire life, even his marriage choices, were shaped by these historical and political developments around him. So it was... that was really at the basis of choosing Abed as the central character.
Yeah, and that makes sense. I mean, you weren't choosing your central character for the one who would tell the most poignant story. It was the one who would help you to tell the story that you were looking for. Yeah. And was Huda the person who he was?
No, he said that Nancy's story was the more... She really went through... Job-like torture after the accident.
Yeah, that might... there you go. I would like to talk about the way that both of the places that you write about were created. Jonathan, you knew the woman who named the neighbourhood you grew up in, Boreham Hill. Did I say that right?
Boreham Hill.
Hill, yes. Yeah. And she appears in both Fortress and Book and Crime novel, where she's the old lady. And you write, the neighbourhood is a fantasy. She made it up. How did she invent the neighbourhood, and how has it continued to be invented and reinvented?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I circle it and circle it in the book. You know, what is it to even have the idea of a neighborhood? And I don't know how Adelaide or other Australian cities are divided up, but the way people think about New York City now is that everyone will know very specifically what neighborhood they live in, and there's a boundary line usually that they can refer to, or maybe it'll be slightly disputed. They'll say, well, no, you know, Clinton Hill ends here and this other one picks up over here. But this idea that it's a kind of a meaningful, tangible fact is never really disputed. Mm. They're seen as having some kind of meaning or provenance that defines people's choices in where they live and what kind of person they are.
Yeah.
But this is all like a kind of crazy set of fictions, and some of them are very fresh fictions. And this became compelling to me by circumstance, because I was in a place that was invented, both invented and under dispute, and in some ways, mockery for the invention when I was a kid. You know, we knew it wasn't a hill. There's no hill in Borum Hill. So that was a first clue. And then the fact that everyone could point at Helen Buckler's house and say, Helen made up the name in 1964 meant, well, so what was the name before? It begs this question. You're going to relate to so much of this, right? And yet, you know, so much meaning hung on these ideas and these assertions. And we also absorbed them into our bodies and made meaning out of them in our own way. Mm. You know, I would produce the word when I was asked where I came from. And I would do work without even noticing it to make it more tangible or to give it character or identity. Because it was where I was from, and I didn't want that to be a nonsense thing. But of course, it had older names. It also had no name. The line that she'd drawn, it wasn't that the box that became Borum Hill, this set of initially 8 city blocks, nothing really, was Borum Hill, and then it was something else before. It was just a passage. It was a terrain that had houses in it. It also had factories and rooming houses and a jail and housing projects and abandoned lots. And so defining what it was and who it was for was a lot more elaborate than just saying who'd been there once and who was there now. Mm. Although that itself was an enormous, enormous thing to think about. Or refuse to think about, which of course was being done all over the place.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think that's something that, I once lived in a suburb that was named after a train station in an attempt to make it cooler than the rest of the suburb. And, you know, reading what you, about Borum Hill made me think of that. Obviously, Nathan, you can speak to this kind of idea. I was really fascinated to read that you've spoken to Danny Terzo, the man who oversaw the reconfiguration of the West Bank during the Oslo Accords and created the maps that carved the West Bank into A, B and C, those three areas. And with different levels of Palestinian self-governance. You've described Area C, the largest area, which was 73% on one early map, as an ocean of Israeli control surrounding 165 islands of areas A or B. Can you explain to us what those three areas mean for the people living within them and the consequences for the lives of everyday Palestinians?
Sure. So Danny Terzo was an IDF colonel who was a territorial expert, in part because he had served in Hebron and he had lived in a settlement in the greater Hebron area, and then he later lived in a settlement called Kfar Adumim, which is in the greater Jerusalem area and is partially on the land of Abed's town, Anata. And Danny had great expertise on Israel's territorial interests, and during the Oslo negotiations and almost all subsequent negotiations, Danny was brought in to be the map maker. he was famously called by Yasser Arafat Abu Kharita, which is father of the map, but Danny swears that the way that Yasser Arafat would pronounce it was Abu Kharta, which is father of bullshit. So Danny was responsible during the Oslo process with defining what Oslo was an idea that grew out of the First Intifada. This uprising, this passage where I read where Abed was in jail during the 1987 to 1993 uprising, you know, the first two decades of Israeli rule, of Israeli occupation of the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza, were pretty quiet. And the First Intifada really took everyone by surprise. And it was as a result of that uprising that the defense minister at the time, Yitzhak Rabin, but also many others around him, came to the conclusion that this system as it exists is not sustainable. And we need to figure out a way to make it smoother for us. And the way to do that was to give Palestinians limited autonomy. And the major concession that Israel made, which was inconceivable prior to the First Intifada, was that the PLO, which was in exile, the leadership of the PLO, was going to be permitted for the first time to return to Palestine. They were going to be allowed to come back to parts of the West Bank and Gaza. And Danny had to come up with the maps for what the Palestinian autonomy would look like, what the terms of it would be. And the basic idea was that every part of the land where Israeli settlements or military bases existed was going to be one big contiguous area called Area C, which is today about 62% of the West Bank. And then within that sea of Area C, there would be little islands of Palestinian autonomy, which were areas A and B. In Area A, Palestinians had more autonomy. In B, there was more of a division between Israeli administration and security control and Palestinian autonomy. And the basic idea was that densely populated Palestinian areas, the centers of Nablus and Jenin and Hebron and Ramallah, those were areas that Israel would rather not have its troops. They didn't want them to be patrolling the kasbahs and to be stabbed by random youth. And so they wanted to have the Palestinians have this limited autonomy in those city centers. And that was the establishment of what is known today as the Palestinian Authority. So Area A and B together make up less than 40% of the West Bank. And just to give you a bigger picture of what this means in terms of the total area under Israeli control of historic Palestine, all of the areas of Palestinian autonomy, including Gaza and Areas A and B in the West Bank, all of them together make up about 10% of historic Palestine, of the territory under Israel's control today. And the remaining 90% are the State of Israel within its pre-1967 borders, the annexed East Jerusalem and the dozens of villages that were whose lands were annexed surrounding Jerusalem, and Area C, which is administered by Israel. And later in the book, Danny designs the wall. He designs the separation barrier that runs in and out of the West Bank and in and out of East Jerusalem. And he chooses the route that it runs through in East Jerusalem and decides, rather than having it adhere to the municipal boundary, what he does is he reroutes it in certain places that, again, the overriding logic here is where there's a very dense Palestinian population, even if they're formerly residents of Jerusalem with blue IDs, push them out. If you can do it without relinquishing too much land, push them to the West Bank side of the wall, and that was what was done in this enclave that the parents and teachers in the book come from.
Thank you so much for explaining that to us. I mean, it was amazing to think that you got to speak to the person responsible for that. Was that hard to do? Like, did you, to dig around and find him? Or?
No, Danny is he gives tours. He's he's very proud of his accomplishments, yeah. And he's not shy.
Yeah. Okay, well, there you go. Glad I asked that. In a moment, I'm going to invite just a very limited questions. We probably will only have room for one or two. If you have a burning question, please come up to the mic in the middle here. I'm going to ask Jonathan one last question first. And I will say, can you please, Adelaide Writers Week has a zero tolerance for racism and disrespectful language. If you're asking a question, please be civil and do remember it's a question and not a statement because we only have limited time. Jonathan, the title of your book is somewhat ironic. It's not a crime novel in the traditional sense, but you did set out to catalogue crimes committed in the Brooklyn neighbourhood you write about in a way that really complicates the idea of what a crime is. So they range from mugging and assaults to the cancer-causing solvent factory in the neighbourhood that was one of the top 10 polluters of the 1970s in the US, predatory real estate operators, stealing of land from the Kanasi Indians, and you really show how the official definition of crime is connected to systems of power. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, right. So it's sort of a teasing title. Mm. And it's also a self-referential title because I, you know, with the first of the three, which I described briefly, Motherless Brooklyn, I backed into being a successful crime writer who wrote a famous book about Brooklyn. Motherless Brooklyn sort of does that. Has a detective, has an antagonist, has a solution. You know, the pieces come together, right? So it can be a crime story. Well, these pieces don't really come together. And so I'm kind of flirting with the reader, saying, do you want a crime story? Mm. You want a real crime story? How big a crime story do you want? Mm. Maybe you can be the detective, and you can read all these clues, and you can decide which crime in this book is the crime in the title. Mm. It's really about making the story, making the question the book asks as large as possible.
Yeah.
So I hope it's not too irritating.
No, I loved that. I love, you know, books that ask you to enter the meaning making of the book with the writer. So, yeah, thank you for that.
Thank you.
Do we have a question here?
Yes, but there'll be a short commentary I'd like to make.
Very, very short. We've only really got time for one.
I understand.
Yeah.
When Nathan was talking about everything that happened in terms of which hospitals the kids might have gone to and all of that sort of stuff, I was reminded of when I had to visit a dear friend from a kibbutz in hospital in Israel. And the nurses, the doctors, the attendants were all Jewish and Arab Israeli. You went to the wards were Jewish and Arab Israeli. There was no separation whatsoever. And they got the same sort of treatment. Now, you have spoken a great deal. You were going to talk about Jerusalem, supposedly, but you didn't really talk about Jerusalem. You talked about the West Bank. Is there anything from all the years that you've been living in Jerusalem that you can say in a positive viewpoint about what goes on in Jerusalem, particularly with the Jewish Israeli and the Arab Israelis?
Thank you. You know, that some of the scenes in the book take place in a hospital in West Jerusalem, Hadassah Hospital at En Karim. And you know, I have characters in the book who are a Palestinian nurse and a Palestinian social worker and an Israeli Jewish social worker who lives in a nearby settlement. And I try and depict what that relationship between those characters is in the hospital and what it feels like for the Palestinian nurse who, you know, he famously was actually permitted to attend Prime Minister Ariel Sharon when he had a stroke. Was in the same hospital, and this Palestinian nurse, a male nurse, he was allowed to be among those caring for Sharon when he had a stroke, and this somehow the press got wind of it, and there were headlines in the Israeli press about the Arab nurse allowed to care for Sharon, which on one hand was a positive story, on the other hand, felt entirely racist to him. And so, you know, Jerusalem is one of the most segregated cities in the world. There are separate bus lines for Palestinians and Jews really don't go into Palestinian neighborhoods. They couldn't even name them on the map. You have, in East Jerusalem, you have Jews are able to reclaim properties that they can point to that were in their family prior to the 1948 war, but you know, most of West Jerusalem, there are Palestinian claimants to those properties who can't do the same thing. So no, Jerusalem is at the heart of the book, and the relations between Jews and Palestinians in Jerusalem is something that exists throughout it.
Thank you. I'm afraid that we only had time for that question in the end, but I'm sure that you can find Nathan and ask him. Look, thank you so much, all of you, for being here. Thank you, Nathan and Jonathan. That was really enjoyable conversation.
Thank you. That's great.
Thank you. And I would like to remind you all that the books are available in the book tent, and Nathan and Jonathan will be around for signing. I believe Nathan's books are very few left, so be quick.